Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 423, titled, I've Got a Secret, Update on September 11th and Related Subjects. This is being recorded on September 8th of the year 2003. Before I get into the main body of the broadcast, sister station WFMU is archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio, more recent programs streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, older programs available for download only at a longer URL linked not only to the first WFMU address, but also to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website. Spitfire is a CD duplication service that has all of the programs I've done over the years, and they have a Real Audio-equipped website, which not only features the latest pair of half-hour segments for download only on Real Audio, but which also has long descriptions of the various programs available, including long, annotated, detailed descriptions of the For the Record programs. Visit the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. And again, there are links from the Spitfire website to both of the WFMU websites. As I'm speaking on September 8th of 2003, the WFMU download website is up and running, and they're still working on the streaming programs. My understanding from the WFMU management is that they will be up and running before too much longer. They've had some computer problems. Now, this broadcast, For the Record 423, derives its title from an old quiz show called I've Got a Secret in For the Record programs 403 and 409. I talked about, I titled those Let's Make a Deal, and that was named for an old quiz show of that name. This is named for another old jive quiz show, I've Got a Secret, or perhaps it should be called Bush Has Some Secrets. But we're going to be taking a look at some of the things that have been kept relatively quiet or completely obscured from view, and the analysis of these things is becoming more and more evidence of altogether sinister behavior on the part of the Bush administration. I would caution against a simplistic analysis of September 11th and related events. It is a very complex event. In my opinion, this is quite literally a continuation of the Second World War with a Third Reich and an Axis that has gone underground and is utilizing peoples in the Arab and Islamic world as proxy warriors, in combination with a very powerful fifth column located within the American power elite, including and especially the Bush administration, that aims at the attack from without and the subversion from within of the United States, and the goal being to subjugate and or destroy the U.S. And people should not be misunderstand the meaning of my words, because I think basically this is it for this country, unless the American people and elements of the military and the intelligence community, and basically either this country is going to be made real or it's finished. I think the hour is at hand. Now, let's begin the substantive discussion with an article from the New York Times of Thursday, September 4th of 2003. This is an article by Eric Lichtblau, Dateline Washington, headlined, White House Approved Departure of Saudis After September 11th, XAIDE says. Top White House officials personally approved the evacuation of dozens of influential Saudis, including relatives of Osama bin Laden, from the United States in the days after the September 11, 2001 attacks, when most flights were still grounded, a former White House advisor said today. The advisor, Richard Clark, who ran the White House crisis team after the attacks but has since left the Bush administration, said he agreed to the extraordinary plan because the Federal Bureau of Investigation assured him that the departing Saudis were not linked to terrorism. The White House feared that the Saudis could face retribution, unquote, for the hijackings if they remained in the United States, Mr. Clark said. The fact that relatives of Mr. bin Laden and other Saudis had been rushed out of the country became public soon after the September 11th attacks, but questions have lingered about the circumstances of their departure, and Mr. Clark's statements provided the first acknowledgement that the White House had any direct involvement in the plan and that senior administration officials personally signed off on it. Mr. Clark first made his remarks about the plan in an article in Vanity Fair due out Thursday, and he expanded on those remarks today in an interview and in congressional testimony. The White House said today that it had no comment on Mr. Clark's statements. The disclosure came just weeks after the classified part of a congressional report on the September 11th attack suggested that Saudi Arabia had financial links to the hijackers, and Mr. Clark's comments are likely to fuel accusations that the United States has gone soft on the Saudis because of diplomatic concerns. Senator Charles E. Schumer, Democrat of New York, seized on Mr. Clark's comments to call on the White House to conduct an investigation into the hasty departures of about 140 Saudis from the United States in the days after the attacks. Mr. Schumer said in an interview that he suspected that some of the Saudis who were allowed to leave, particularly two relatives of Mr. bin Laden, who he said had links to terrorist groups themselves, could have shed light on the events of September 11th. This is just another example of our country coddling the Saudis and giving them special privileges that others would never get, Mr. Schumer said, again quoting, "It's almost as if we didn't want to find out what links existed," unquote. Skipping down, by the way, the Vanity Fair article would be the Vanity Fair issue for October of 2003. It would have been out the last Thursday, which would have been September 4th. But the Vanity Fair investigation quotes Dale Watson, skipping down here, by the way, but the Vanity Fair investigation quotes Dale Watson, the former head of counterterrorism at the FBI, as saying that the departing Saudis, quote, "were not subject to serious interviews or interrogations," unquote. Mr. Watson could not be reached for comment today. The article depicts an elaborate but hurried evacuation carried out within a week of the hijackings in which private planes picked up Saudis from 10 cities around the country. Some aviation and bureau officials said that they were upset by the operation because the government had not lifted flight restrictions for the general public, but those officials said they lacked the power to stop the evacuation, the article says. Skipping down again, Mr. Schumer said he doubted the thoroughness of a rushed review by the Bureau, and in a letter to the White House today, he said the Saudis appeared to have gotten a free pass, unquote, despite their possible knowledge about the attacks. Quote, "I find it hard to believe that 2 days after 9-1-1, the FBI would even know what questions to ask and who to ask it of," Mr. Schumer said in an interview, again quoting, "The FBI's confidence that nothing of value was lost here is questionable," unquote. Well, obviously, this to a certain extent speaks for itself. A few points that I want to touch on. As we've seen in numerous broadcasts, including For the Record program number 341, there are abundant indications that many members of the bin Laden family are, in fact, implicated in the activities of al-Qaeda. It's not just Osama, and they're not alienated from him, as is professed publicly. And I would also note that the person who was installed as head of the FBI in the summer of 2001, Robert Mueller, is the individual who was in charge of the U.S. investigation of the BCCI case. The BCCI case was an enormous investigation, which was badly attenuated. Had it gone as far as it might have, it not only would have uncovered much of the Iran-Contra shenanigans, including the elder George Bush's involvement in those, but it also would have uncovered, among other things, evidentiary tributaries running to the Bush family's business connections to the bin Laden family, including the bin Laden connections to Arbusto Energy. That's the younger George Bush's first energy company. I would also note that there were members of the bin Laden family present in Washington, D.C. at the annual investor conference of the Carlyle Group. That is yet another business undertaking that links the Bush and bin Laden families, and the elder George Bush was in attendance at the annual investor conference of the Carlyle Group. He was at that on September 11th of 2001. However, he and Barbara Bush managed to get on an airplane and wing their way well into the heartland before the attacks came down. I would note that one of the people at the Carlisle Annual Investor Conference, who was watching the Twin Towers go down, along with members of the Bin Laden family, was former Bush the Elder Secretary of State James Baker, whose law firm not only handles the legal work for the Carlisle Group, but who is also whose law firm is also representing Prince Sultan, one of the defendants in the trillion-dollar lawsuit against members of the Saudi elite in connection with September 11th. I would also note that we've discussed the departure of members of the Bin Laden family in a number of other broadcasts, FTR 337 and FTR 347 among them. Still more about Bush's secrets, or his desire anyway to keep some things secret. San Francisco Chronicle, Saturday, August 2nd of 2003. Following story from the Chronicle News Service's Dateline Washington headlined, "Report says Saudis aided 9/11 hijackers." Subtitled, "Section Bush won't declassify said to contain finding." This article reads in part, "The 27 pages deleted from a congressional report on September 11th depict a Saudi government that not only provided significant money and aid to the suicide hijackers, but also allowed potentially hundreds of millions of dollars to flow to Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups through suspect charities and other fronts, according to sources familiar with the document. One U.S. official who has read the classified section said it described, quote, direct involvement of senior Saudi government officials in a coordinated and methodical way directly to the hijackers, unquote, as well as, again quoting, very direct, very specific links that cannot be passed off as rogue, isolated, or coincidental, unquote. Another official said, quote, it's really damning. What it says is that not only Saudi entities or nationals are implicated in 9/11, but the Saudi government as well. And I would also note that, as we're going to see later on, in addition to Bush's business connections to the Bin Laden family, there is a direct overlap between the funding sources that were targeted by the March 20th, 2002 Operation Green Quest raids and the Republican Party's ethnic outreach organization, those links involving not only Talat Atman, a close Bush family ally and a director of Harkin Energy, another of the younger Bush's business ventures, but also Karl Rove and Grover Norquist, two of the key functionaries in the Republican Party. Karl Rove, the Machiavellian figure who pretty much runs the White House and pretty much the country at this point. Grover Norquist works closely with Karl Rove and is the point man for the Republican Party's tax cutting program. Those tax cuts, in combination with the military buildup that was occasioned by September 11th, and in particular the flight of capital from the United States that was already underway to a certain extent before September 11th, but that is has been accentuated by that, has led to a critical situation in which there are enormous budget deficits, and there is a projection in a report, as we talked about in 412, there was a projection in a report that was commissioned by former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill before he was fired that projects the overall budget deficits at $44.3 trillion as a result of these budget cuts, which not only threatens the fiscal health of the United States as a whole, but in a war which, although the administration has made some serious mistakes, such as the precipitous attack on Iraq without going through the international community, the fact of the matter is this is a very real war. It is as real as World War II. It is an extension of World War II. And unfortunately, I think among the institutions in this country that's going to find itself bankrupt and incapable of functioning is going to be the military itself already, and this is something we'll take up in future programs. The military is stretched very, very thin in Iraq. The troops there are not getting enough food. They're not getting the proper water. They're not getting very good food. They're not getting the proper amount of water, which is essential for troops functioning in a desert environment, and valuable intelligence resources have been drained as a result of the precipitous Iraq commitment. And there is a very, very serious state of affairs developing in that regard. Also, there are accounts of, surprise, surprise, Saudi nationals crossing the border into Iraq. One of the points that I made in For the Record programs 403 and 409, both titled Let's Make a Deal, Parts 1 and 2, was that I had hypothesized that there may have been a deal cut in exchange for the Saudis allowing the Bush administration to use the bases in their territory in exchange for the war in Iraq. I hypothesized that there may very well have been a number of quid pro quos. One, the Saudi link to September 11th would be suppressed by the Bush administration. It certainly would appear that that is, in fact, going on. I hypothesized that the bin Laden family, a principal construction interest in the Middle East, would get some of the action, so to speak, in the rebuilding of Iraq. And there are indications that through a Bechtel subsidiary and possibly the Fluor Corporation, that may very well be the case as well. And I also hypothesized that there would be an apparent suppression or some form of disenfranchisement of the Shiite majority in Iraq, or there would be some way that they would be marginalized or stirred into chaos or in some way subordinated to the Sunni minority. It remains to be seen if that part of that prediction does in fact take place. More about the secrets that the Bush administration is keeping or attempting to keep. New York Times, Wednesday, July 30th of 2003. Bush refuses to declassify Saudi section of report. It's by David Johnston and Douglas Jahl, J-E-H-L. President Bush refused today to declassify a 28-page chapter of a congressional report on the September 2001 attacks. He said that disclosure of the deleted section, which centers on allegations about Saudi Arabia's role in financing the hijackings, would help the enemy, unquote, and compromise the administration's campaign against terror. Well, it certainly is interesting that we're not being told what exactly took place. We've already had in the previous article a hint of one of the things contained in that report. More about alleged Saudi government involvement in the attacks. This from the New York Times of August 2nd of 2003. This article is by James Risen and David Johnston, headlined, Report on 9/11 suggests a role by Saudi spies. The classified part of a congressional report on the terrorist attacks on September 11, 2001, says that two Saudi citizens who had at least indirect links with two hijackers were probably Saudi intelligence agents and may have reported to Saudi government officials, according to people who have seen the report. These findings, according to several people who have read the report, help to explain why the classified part of the report has become so politically charged, causing strains between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Senior Saudi officials have denied any links between their government and the attacks and have asked that the section be declassified, but President Bush has refused. People familiar with the report and who spoke on condition of not being named said that the two Saudi citizens, Omar al-Bayoumi and Osama Basnan, operated in a complex web of financial relationships with officials of the Saudi government. The sections that focus on them draw connections between the two men, two hijackers, and Saudi officials. The report urges further investigation of the two men and their contacts with the hijackers because of unresolved questions about their relationship and whether they had any involvement in the 9/11 plot. The edited 28-page section of the report, produced by a joint panel of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, also says that a Muslim cleric in San Diego was a central figure in a support network that aided the same two hijackers. Most connections drawn in the report between the men, Saudi intelligence, and the attacks are circumstantial, several people who have read the report said. So again, it remains to be seen, and we haven't seen it yet, whether this suggestion, that namely that Saudi spies were involved in September 11th, is in fact substantive. Among the things that are being actively suppressed by the Bush administration concerns the reports that that administration was privy to prior to September 11th. This article is from Newsday. The article is by Marie Coco, C-O-C-C-O. It's datelined August 7th of 2003. Headlined, U.S. clamps secrecy on warnings before 9/11. It's not just the Saudi secret that's being kept. The recent report of the Joint Congressional Committee that probed intelligence failures before the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon reveals what the Bush administration doesn't want Americans to know about the American government. You would not know this from media accounts about this report. They have dwelled on what the Bush administration doesn't want us to know about the Saudi government. This is the famous 28-page chapter, a series of blank lines across page after page, that the president refuses to declassify despite the pleadings of the bipartisan group of lawmakers and the Saudi government itself. The dust-up over Saudi secrets is exquisitely convenient. It obscures George W. Bush's relentless hold on U.S. secrets and on information he maintains should be secret, though it has not necessarily been before now. The report's appendix hints at what these secrets are and why they are kept. Quote, access limitations encountered by the joint inquiry, the section is titled. The White House refused to provide contents of the president's daily brief. This would clear up questions about how much specific information President Bush received about an impending attack during the spring and summer of 2001, a period in which the intelligence community was reporting with alarm that a spectacular, unquote, attack against the United States involving mass casualties, unquote, was in the works. And that again from Newsday of August 7th of 2003. There was a column in the Village Voice by James Ridgway, his weekly Mondo Washington column, that gives us a clearer picture of some of what the administration is trying to suppress. This is from the Village Voice of July 31st of 2003. It's from the Mondo Washington column by James Ridgway. It's titled Bush's 9/11 Secrets, subtitled The government received warnings of bin Laden's plans to attack New York and D.C. And some of this has been public for quite some time, but by way of reviewing the nature of the briefings that the administration was given. Even though Bush has refused to make parts of the 9/11 report public, one thing is startlingly clear. The U.S. government had received repeated warnings of impending attacks, and attacks using planes directed at New York and Washington for several years. The government never told us about what it knew was coming. See for yourself. The report lists 36 different summaries of warnings dating back to 1997. Among them, quote, in September 1998, the intelligence community obtained information that bin Laden's next operation might involve flying an explosive-laden aircraft into a U.S. airport and detonating it, unquote. Quote, in the fall of 1998, the intelligence community obtained information concerning a bin Laden plot involving aircraft in the New York and Washington, D.C. areas, unquote. In March of 2000, the intelligence community obtained information regarding the types of targets that operatives of bin Laden's network might strike. The Statue of Liberty was specifically mentioned, as were skyscrapers, ports, airports, and nuclear power plants. Unquote. By the way, I would note that in 2004, the Republican convention is going to be in New York City, and if I'm not mistaken, I think the Democratic convention is scheduled to be in Boston. And there were reports during this past summer that attacks on New York and Boston, among other East Coast cities, were projected. So, who knows? One or both of the conventions might get lit up. It'd be interesting to see which one, wouldn't it? Certainly, we should hope that there is no more mass terrorist incident, but I would note that the warnings in the summer of 2003 mentioned apparent warnings from al-Qaeda-linked outlets that devout Muslims in New York and Boston, among other eastern cities, should basically get out of town. And I would note that among the cities mentioned, Boston and New York, are the cities that apparently the Republican and Democratic conventions are going to be held in. Continuing now with this Mondo Washington column by James Ridgway from the Village Voice. Maybe the Bush team dismissed warning signals as the discoveries of an overly hyped-up Clinton team, but John Dean, a White House counsel under Nixon who has become a guide to deciphering reports on September 11th, says this is unlikely. Condi Rice, Bush's national security advisor, quote, stated in a May 16, 2002 press briefing that on August 6 of 2001, the President Daily Brief, or PDB, included information about bin Laden's methods of operation from an historical perspective dating back to 1997. Rice also said at this briefing that the PDB pointed out that bin Laden might hijack an airline and take hostages to gain release of one of their operatives. She said the warning was generalized, unquote. No date, place, or method. As Dean notes, how could Rice, having known all this, say that the administration had no idea, quote, these people would take an airplane and slam it into the World Trade Center, take another one and slam it into the Pentagon, unquote. Again, quoting, in sum, the September 11th report of the Congressional Inquiry indicates that the intelligence community was very aware that bin Laden might fly an airplane into an American skyscraper, says Dean. Again, quoting, given the fact that there had already been an attempt to bring down the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center with a bomb, how could Rice say what she did? Unquote. We don't know because Bush has invoked executive privilege to withhold from Congress this key briefing on August 6, 2001. We do know that despite years of warnings from the intelligence community, the government had apparently taken no steps to protect the Eastern Seaboard or any other American border from attack. There were no fighter aircraft ready to respond immediately to a threat. The government undertook no measures to increase airport security. This entire affair has been forced into a discussion of what the CIA knew or didn't know and what it told or didn't tell the White House. But the questioning needs to focus on what Bush knew or didn't know and what he did or didn't do in response to what his intelligence advisors told him. This is becoming a very damning body of information. I would note that on August 4th of 2002, as reported in the Wall Street Journal of April 4th of 2002, as reported in the Wall Street Journal of April 18th of 2002, on page A4, Talat Otman, close associate of the Bush family, a director of Harkin Energy, interceded with the Secretary of the Treasury, who since was relieved of his job, on behalf of the institutions and individuals who were targeted by the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002. That is one of the most profound and one of the most damning pieces of information. That, in taken in combination with the rest of this, the articles presented in the rest of this program, adds up to the legal principle of consciousness of guilt. We'll chat more about that in the second side of the show. WFMU.org/Dave Emery, streaming real audio, longer URL available for download only. Link to that address and to the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Within a week or so of the airing of this program, there will be a detailed annotated description of For the Record 423 available on the Real Audio Equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. That concludes side one of For the Record program number 423. I've got a secret. Update on September 11th and related matters being recorded on September 8th of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.